Michael Vandenberg, and I'm the professor of law and co-director of the program at Vandenberg University Law School. And it's my great pleasure to welcome you here to the 6th Annual Environmental Law and Policy Innovation Conference. And let me start by just thanking quickly the Environmental Law Institute, Linda Bregan, who is both the brains and the energy behind this project, as well as being the co-professor for this course. Scott Shang, who is the editor-in-chief of the Environmental Law Reporter, where these comments will be recorded. Lindsay Buddiesso, who's probably there closing the door. Lindsay has done a terrific job helping to set this up. And Leticia Midry, who is here, who is helping us on the technical side today as well. Senator Tom Udall for helping to arrange for this room. We have an expert outside advisory board, and I want to thank them, as well as the students. Could you stand really quickly for one of the students for this LPAR class? We bring 10 third-year students to Washington this year, and we really appreciate all your work on this journal. LPAR is both a class and a publication. We scan over 400 academic articles in the environmental law literature each year, and we try to select 3 to 6 of the very best, based on the notion that they are offering the best specific policy proposals. And we have several goals. One, as you saw from the students being here, one goal is to make sure that we offer an exceptionally grounded and thoughtful experience for the students. The second is to encourage academics to actually stick their neck out a little bit and say something specific on the policy work. I know from my own work that the first several papers I published included a policy section, and every one of my senior colleagues said, no, take that out. We don't do that. We don't do that in the academy. And I felt as though that was undermining actually the quality of theoretical work in the academy, because if you actually have to apply your theory, you're more likely to do it in the university. You can't just assume a standard, as you know, the old joke of Paul Samuelson, the famous economist, started telling this joke where he said, you have an island with an engineer and an economist on the island, and they're stranded, and there's no food on the island except cans. And the engineer says, well, let's develop a mechanism to throw the can against a rock and break the can open, and then we can eat. What does the economist do? The economist says, let's assume a can opener, and then we can eat from the can. In my field, we assume away all the hard questions. Many times, we have to do a policy description, and often can't do that. And then lastly, what we're trying to do here is help move ideas from the academy to the policy world. And if we succeed at today's conference, that's exactly what today's conference is all about. Take some of the best policy ideas from the academic world and help bring them to the table in the policy world. So I'm really pleased to be here. I appreciate the turnout today. And it's now my time to turn this over to Seamus Kelly, who is the editor-in-chief of the Environmental Law and Policy Annual Review and the third-year student at Vanderbilt. Seamus?
And thank you all for being here today. I'm really excited about the 3 articles that are going to be presented throughout the day. I'm going to talk about how we got to where we are with these 3 specific articles. So there are 20 students who made it on to the Environmental Law and Policy Annual Review who are right on competition. And we ran a global search in the top 100 law reviews and all the environmental law journals for the term environment, and logged everything that came up that was about the physical environment. From there, we had about 770 articles that turned up in that. From there, each one of those articles was screened by 2 students to see if it met our criteria, that it was really, really about the environment and also had a really good policy discussion. After we got through that, 2 students went through the remaining articles, and we chose 164 articles to summarize. And then with the professors, we read through those summaries, chose our favorites, put together 20 of the best ones that we made to the advisory board, and after a conference call, we chose new 3 articles, which really blew our minds and were really excited because they cover a really diverse area of environmental law, and it was really informative, and we're so excited to have the comments here as well to offer their insight. Another element that we had is pretty exciting. We're looking at trends in environmental scholarship. So we realize we have this huge backlog of data if we can bring it to you, looking for all the environmental articles. So we're going back and making sure that all the articles are really environmental. because of the working definition that the article need not focus exclusively on environmental laws, but environmental topics should be given more than incidental treatment. It should be integral to the main thrust of the article. And from there, we're putting together these data sets that will really show how important environmental law is in the academy right now. And we're really excited to have that coming out and to really develop that over the years. We're noticing it's been pretty consistent, even this year. There was a little bit of a spike in 2010-2011, which could be based on some of the things that were going on in the world at the time, but we're really excited about presenting this data. So, without any further ado, I'd like to thank you all again for being here, and turn it over to Linda Brady.
Designate critical habitat at the time that the world is being discovered. And put up a habitat of the statue, which is mostly the habitat which is central for the survival of the covering species. And the services have designated quite a lot of this map of people to see it. So it's part of the Pacific Northwest, and it's part of the habitat. And then these maps, which show my home state of Maine, also illustrate again that there are pretty extensive designations in some places. Once that habitat is designated, the primary protection, which is the focus protection, comes from Section 7 of the United States Act, which prohibits federal agencies from taking actions that would destroy or adversely modify them. And this prohibition is implemented through a process of consultation, which in a formal form culminates in what's called a biological opinion from the Fish and Wildlife Service or the National Marine Fisheries Service, assessing whether the harvest is likely to cause adverse modification from the efforts of the moment. And in practice, consultation also usually involves extensive negotiations over potential changes to the project. So this prohibition is just one of three primary regulatory prohibitions in the USA. The other two are prohibition on federal agencies taking actions likely to jeopardize the species, and a prohibition on any person taking actions that are likely to take the species. And both jeopardy and take also can result from habitat. So that begs the question about what the adverse modification position also is whether the position is not. And this is an argument that I developed in some of my documentation myself. But my reading of the statute is that progressive interpretation gives the adverse modification prohibition a lead and greater role in responding to the small incidents of habitat. And that is not what it is. In reality, it's not. Many threatened and endangered species are endangered primarily by incremental changes to their habitat. And so the regulatory provision responds to those changes is potentially quite important. More broadly, environmental lawyers often identify that sort of incremental environmental change as particularly difficult to manage environmental law to respond to. So a regulatory prohibition that yields to those sort of incremental change is interesting on a broader level as well. So that's my reading of how the statute should be implemented. With that said, it's a contested the particularly top agency officials at the National Marine Fisheries Service and Fish and Wildlife Service have often said that the adverse modification provision really has no independent role. And that interpretation in turn is contested by academics and, as you can see from the report below, by some of the agencies on biology. So there's a range of opinions about how these statements should be implemented. In this article, I did talk about the statutory interpretation, but I tried to go beyond that and look at how the agencies were actually interpreting the situation. And I tried to do that in a couple of ways. So first off, my research assistant and I gathered all of the biological opinions that the service has introduced to fish species between 2005 and 2009. And we tracked those for a couple of outcomes. First, primarily, we were looking to see whether they resulted in jeopardy or adverse modification. Then, within that broader set, we zeroed in on a couple of subsets. And in these subsets, we were generally looking for two otherwise comparable species, one of which had critical habitat designated and the other one didn't. And the goal was to see if there was any qualitative or quantitative difference in the methodology that was used in the conservation process. Then I also interviewed agency biologists and I read every adverse modification decision. Well, there's a lot of detail to the results, but here's a quick summary. First, and I think this is the most important result, you can see from this row of yellow zeros here, I did not find in this pool of over then when I took it closer to the state, it was a subject of violence. Again, I couldn't even see a difference either in the methodology or in the outcomes. So again, it seems that the two issues might be different. When I started looking more closely at those subjects, I also started with some reasons for the apparent differences. And this takes a moment to explain, but I'm trying to walk you through it. The first highlighted column on the left there shows the number of biological opinions within those subsets, where the consulting agency fairly clearly anticipated the habitat of individuals as an adult. So if you can see it's a minority of projects, but a significant minority. This shows how many of those projects result in average qualification. And this shows how many of those projects result in state findings under Section 9, and then also how many times the agency anticipated that the state would result in each contested habitat findings. So what this shows is that in a significant subset of projects, the service has anticipated that the action would make habitat conditions worse, and worse enough to kill individual or to harm individual members of the species, but that the change nevertheless did not qualify as adverse in the state. In other words, they just didn't consider the average modification burden applying to their costs. And additionally, in the biological opinions, I never saw a very coherent standard for determining what qualifies as a small farm and what does not. The interviews actually were more nuanced in this way, because in the interviews, biologists told me that they did think that most of them, that they did think the adverse modification was a difference, primarily when they were negotiating adjustments to climate. And I've heard a range of opinions about how much of a difference it makes. Some people said very little, a few said not at all, one said really makes a very big difference. But the consistent, relatively consistent indication is that it did matter in terms of. And the court cases had a limited few questions as well. First and most importantly, the courts were given independent commitment to the average modification approach, giving the case of analysis from records and sometimes coming to some conclusions. The second piece of wisdom here is that the number of cases is growing, although it still remains fairly small when you consider the number of complications that happen. Plaintiffs have been doing fairly well in these cases, which also is interesting. And then finally, the courts, much like the agencies, really seem to be struggling with this question of what qualifies as adverse modification and what is considered as small. So this quote comes from a case that I think is at one extreme of the spectrum of decision. So here, the Ninth Circuit said that the destruction of a couple hundred acres of critical habitat did not trigger a deficit of this amount of destruction of habitat. But there are other cases that come to some of this results, or at least state as a standard. And again, I didn't see anything in the cases where the courts are clearly articulated how to do this. So, on the whole, I think that leads us to a somewhat mixed picture, in which the services clearly are protecting habitat. They're providing more protection to habitat than what's happening in the absence of the species. But the average modification program is playing only a fairly subtle role in providing this protection. And in many cases, even though protection has been provided, it's not enough to remove the adverse impact on habitat resulting from it. So that leads me to the last thing, is that everybody seems to be struggling with these difficult questions, deciding how much time is too much, how much rigorous. So that leads me to a few recommendations. The first, and this comes primarily out of the interviews, is to keep these critical habitats. Almost every time there's a discussion of ESA reform in Congress, critical habitat seems to be on the chopping block, and sometimes there's an enthusiastic support for these issues. And I think that would be a mistake. Even though it has not played all that much of a state, what the biologists consistently told me is that they thought this was a useful concept that they could get more benefit from if the agencies took a harder look and more systematic look at how they were going to implement the average modification rates. The second recommendation is a little bit more complicated. It involves making a few good use of it, and also more importantly, providing more guidance on off-site mitigation. And by off-site mitigation, I mean compensating for the impact on the project location. by not providing that guidance, it becomes a reason or opportunity to cost effectively mitigate some of the impacts and respond to those disorders. Last recommendation is to integrate the process of answering this, how much is too much, into larger plan. And the most logical candidate, I think, is probably right now, the service biologists are confronting this how much is too much on an ad hoc, project by project basis. And that's a really hard way to answer the question. And the apparent result is pretty systemic tolerance for small scale implementation. Even though services are identifying the small scale community as the primary threat to the species. If you integrate that threshold setting process into the planning process, it doesn't make it an easy question to answer, but at least we have the opportunity to ask, how are we going to fit our effects to small companies, thresholds that we set, into an approach that will achieve our larger goals for all of us? And that, I think, represents an issue. So, nothing I've said here in this paper or in this talk that makes this challenge beyond the fall. It's inherently a very difficult thing to do. And with the emergence of challenges of climate change, it's only getting harder. But the central pieces of the paper that I just talked is that there are some incremental improvements that the service can make.
Thank you. Let's see. Okay, very good. Thank you. It is, I'm like the odd man out on this panel. I'm not an academic. I am, of course, these days, I'm a research speaker. I guess that's what I am, as an official at the Department of the Interior trying to implement the Endangered Species Act. I cannot turn down requests on my phone for the Linda Bregan, which is the only positive reason I'm here this morning. As I look at my BlackBerry and see that we have another suppression meeting about an hour and a half. This is an interesting and important topic, and I think Professor Owens has added quite an important element to the literature on this subject. And it's a worthy article for accommodation by LCAD. I think, first, let me acknowledge that in writing a comment, I had the able assistance, a remarkably able assistance of Michael Beaton, who many of you know as a long-time ESA expert, who is now a counselor in our department in the Assistant Secretary of Fish and Wildlife. Wildlife and Parks Operation, and also Martha Williams, who is our associate solicitor in this area, who will shortly be leaving the department to join the faculty at the University of Montana. Both are very thoughtful folks in this arena, and I guess I sort of am in the space of trying to find practical the practical importance of how the ESA works and can work better. Because in our department, although we have 7,000 employees and $14 billion of budget, we are chronically short of resources to deal with the tsunami of Endangered Species Act requirements and obligations that we have. And one of the most frustrating aspects of implementing the ESA, I would say over the last 15 years, has been out of the critical habitat designation process. I go back here, I was also counselor to Bruce Babbitt and deputy secretary in the Clinton administration, when Jamie Clark, your boss, was the director of the Fish and Wildlife Service, and we grappled with the same problem. What's the problem? The problem is that from a practical perspective, as I think Professor Owens has demonstrated, there does not seem to be a lot of benefit to the exercise of identifying critical habitats. Now, I'm going to caveat that, as Professor Owens correctly does, there clearly are some benefits. But I'd like to focus first on why I suggest the benefits of, why I reinforce the data that Professor Owens found that indicates that, that the incremental benefits of critical habitat are modest. I want to focus on why that matters, and that's because of the resources that we have to put into the critical habitat determination at the wrong time in the process and at the expense of other affirmative species protecting actions that we otherwise could take with those resources that are being devoted to the critical habitat determination process. So let's just dwell for a second, for a minute, on the primary features I would suggest of Professor Owens, perhaps thesis is along with it, the primary conclusion that his data generates, which is that what really matters in terms of species protection under the ESA is Section 7. And the listing of a species and the implications of the listing of a species. Once a species is listed, if there is an action, including impacts on habitat, that has the potential to affect that species, to take a species and take is very broadly defined in the ESA, then a consultation has to occur. And a federal action that may affect that species, at least there's a dialogue then that the action agency and the Fish and Wildlife Service, the National Marine Fisheries Service, about whether that action can be modified in a way so that there will not be an impact on the species, or if you're really pushing the envelope, whether there are reasonable and prudent alternatives to the action that can protect the species. That's the guts of the process. That's where all the dialogue occurs. That's where federal actions get adjusted to move away from the danger of affecting the species. It's a good process, and it is a productive process. And as the professor's work has demonstrated, there doesn't seem to be independent impact of the adverse modification to critical habitat on that process. No doubt, if critical habitat has been identified as part of the conversation, but query whether it has independent vitality. So what's the problem then? So perhaps critical habitat is not particularly important in terms of the mechanics of how the ESA gets implemented, but it does have some side benefits that the professor notes and that I will acknowledge. The question to me is, as a agency with limited resources, are those side benefits worth it or not in terms of the energy that goes into critical habitat determination? And by and large, I think not. Why? A couple of key points. One is that it's very hard to identify critical habitat. And number two, the law says you have to do it when you are listing the species. And you typically, the Fish and Wildlife Service typically does not have the information available to make a critical habitat determination at that time. You're making the threshold determination that species is in danger. You've done a 12-month finding that is for the first time really trying to get whatever data there is. Yes, it's in danger. The question of having to answer the question at the same time will tell us acre by acre where a critical habitat is for the species. Holy cow, how are we going to do that? Ironically, as Dave notes, the ESA anticipates that recovery plans will be developed. The scientists, after a listing has happened, the scientists will get together and figure out what's the best pathway for recovery. Now, in that context, knowing the specially sensitive lands, the critical habitat, if you will, is a natural outgrowth of that scientific evaluation effort.
Well, that's later. That's done by scientists, outside scientists, peer review. It's perfect. That's when critical habitat should be identified as a pathway for recovery. But no, it's got to be, because the way the law is written, it's fast-forwarded to essentially coincident with the listing decision when none of that science is available. Interestingly, and some folks like Steve Burroughs will remember this, in the 90s, there was a bipartisan effort to revise the Endangered Species Act, and one of the key elements of it was to change the timing for critical habitat determination, push it off to the recovery phase, the recovery plan phase of the ESA. The other reason why this is important from a balancing perspective is that the resources that are going into defending litigation and pushing through somewhat prematurely, I would argue, in some cases, critical habitat determination, are taking away from our ability to do good consultation and thorough consultation. We just don't have the resources. Now, let me make a couple of other comments. I do prescribe to the point that Dave makes that critical habitat is important and it does play a role and it can be helpful. But let me give a couple of nuances to this point, because it is a bit of a double-edged sword. And I also want to go into a little bit the role of the economic evaluation of critical habitat, which has been the subject of a lot of litigation. So the proposition is that the critical habitat determination per se is typically not meaningful, not very meaningful, because of the operation of Section 7 essentially occupying the field in terms of activity on the ground. What that has meant is that when Fish and Wildlife Service does the economic analysis of the impact of critical habitat, as it's required to do under the ESA, the ESA has an economic element to critical habitat determination, it typically finds very little incremental economic impact associated with the critical habitat determination. Why? For the exact reasons that Professor Owen has now documented very compellingly. In fact, it's quite interesting. The president issued an order, was it a year ago now, maybe 2 years ago, my years are blending together, in connection with our reevaluation of critical habitat for the Northwest spotted owl, in the Northwest spotted owl in the Northwest, where he asked us to begin doing the economic analysis when we propose critical habitat instead of later in the process, which a new final rule is on its way out on that, and I think that's a fine thing to do. The economic analysis, though, typically indicates that there's not much incremental economic harm here. The other aspect of the economic analysis and sort of balancing in there is that it gives the Fish and Wildlife Service, we believe, some flexibility to distinguish acreage that might otherwise be critical habitat based on other economic and policy considerations. And that is why, for example, in identifying the critical habitat for the spotted owl, which is pretty darn generous, I think about 9 million acres, as I recall, private lands are not included. Why? And this is another important teaching point on critical habitat. Critical habitat determinations are important, are tied to federal action. It is when a federal action is going to affect critical habitat that critical habitat sort of comes to the fore. And particularly for unoccupied critical habitat. Private action, where there's no federal action, critical habitat is essentially unimportant, except psychologically, perhaps, arguably. Now, there's probably some economists in the room that will take issue with that.
But more importantly, our administration is taking the view that if there are conservation planning efforts, either federal, state, or private, on otherwise potentially designatable critical habitat, we typically are not going to identify those critical habitats because we want to encourage those types of voluntary landscape and landscape level conservation activities. And so what we're trying to do is use what is a very blunt instrument, this critical habitat determination, to help actually encourage other ESA actions that we think have more conservation benefits than the designation of critical habitat per se. As you can tell, I'm getting into this a little bit, but I better stop. Let me just conclude here by mentioning a few points at the end that really go to Professor Owens's main conclusions. He concludes that critical habitat does have a benefit, despite the fact that the data suggests that it's not a key operative provision in the ESA world. And I do agree with that. I think the exercise of identifying critical habitat is a good one. My major concern is timing, resource needs, the fact this has been fish in the barrel litigation for folks who, because there's a deadline and we miss these deadlines, and so we've been spending a huge amount of, to my mind, relatively unproductive time sending off lawsuits in this arena. But it is a useful exercise, again, to me, more useful if it's in the context of a recovery plan or a landscape level attention to the needs of the species. Secondly, I think that Professor Owens, in the second point on offset mitigation, has struck a very, very important chord. We have been focusing under the Obama administration on landscape level impacts to species and to other values of our landscape. Our big effort to look at the six southwestern states identified solar energy zones as the right places for major solar projects, identify exclusion areas, et cetera. What we're doing with the sage grouse right now in 11 western states, trying to find big picture ways to protect that species. Large scale off-site mitigation needs to be a big part of this. It has not been to date, as Dave correctly points out. And mitigation generally has fallen into very narrow categories. As Dave pointed out, wetlands, ESA, let's kind of deal with this little issue here, this little issue here. Our public lands, I think, and private lands together, like they're doing with the Desert Renewable Energy Conservation Planning effort involving 29 acres in California right now, we need to look at that whole area and come up with plans, including offsite mitigation plans. You're going to hear more about that from this department in the next few weeks with some major announcements. Finally, his point that follows on this, that we should be looking at larger planning processes, is a point that we embrace. And what I hope comes out of some of these discussions is that somehow we can put down our arms and our litigation gladiator tendencies and not overemphasize critical habitat in terms and tie us in knots dealing with critical habitat determinations when there are so many other ESA tools that are so much more important for the species and are a better use of our limited resources. I can stay for a little while. granted module has shortly after published, and actually I completed some of my college and sent to college, which we would strengthen some along the way to advantage not just stimulus, but actually score through, score out and stuff, biological changes. I've gone through my fair bit of but I haven't been close to that, that level of analysis. The other thing I'd also like to say, and maybe this is part of the question, that is at the end, is I'm actually very interested in seeing what additional analysis on database. My experience is largely as a practitioner, I certainly can't see some of these issues in the land of the species in the landscape. But what has clearly been lacking, I think, really since species has been active, is really, with respect to Section 7, a comprehensive analysis. Now, a lot of what we base our assumptions on are anecdotal, obviously very small subset. And I think instead he's now accumulated this data, I think it's extremely helpful in providing additional information. Even within the subset you look at, the relatively small subset of even just all Section 7 biological. I would urge you to use that database. Let me say, first of all, a little bit initially, maybe perhaps to add a little bit more background in terms of how Section 7 works, specifically the issue of special. Professor Owen's paper, which is entitled Small Arms, I think in the larger scheme of how Section 7 works, I think is a bit misleading in that it's the way Section 7 framework is regulatory process works is federal agencies are required to consult on any action that may affect it. That does exceedingly low threshold. Once they get into the consultation process, they basically have two options. They can go formal, which ends with existing biological changes, and that's sort of the universe of consultation that they're only beginning. The other avenue they can take, in fact, is the avenue that vast majority of federal actions that go into the consultation process, that's called the formal consultation. And what that is when the agency, and then with the concurrence of either the Fish Monitors or the National Fisheries Service, determines that action may affect, but it's not quite the adverse effect of the species. That's the end of what's called the formal consultation. And that process can involve anything from phone calls, it can involve meetings, but historically that is where most of, at least in terms of numbers, where most consultations occur. And it's been my experience that a great deal of conservation occurs through that kind of process. So again, I would actually start from the premise that once you get to the stage of actually formal consultation, get to the point where the biological change is going to be required, particularly given that what we're dealing with, obviously, is species for which determinations are already been made that there is a threat of extinction or the likelihood to come from in the future. Once you cross that threshold in the general consultation, this is a threshold matter. I don't is a fairly, I think, fairly effective process in place for dealing with environmental and sort of spending issues. The other thing that that process also provides, I think, is really enough. I think there's a lot of action that occurs with a lot of stuff. That is where a lot of discussions take place in terms of modifying projects. Basically, ways to actually avoid impact or run the farm. So, let's think a little bit about a couple of the issues that I see with administration and formal section of the conservation project. Two fundamental problems that I have seen with recent engineering that I've worked on with the Texas and Conservation Project, and this is not just a critical aspect, but even in situations where there is no critical aspect, I do not think the services place enough emphasis on focusing on really what at the end of the day is the fundamental goal in which we can recover the I think the process is too often been approached as what I would call a how long can go step, which is we can continue to keep CEOs and have a indefinitely until we hit some undefined step. And notwithstanding the fact that the services regulatory definition of jeopardy specifically requires them to assess the impact of the act on jeopardy, in my experience, that really plays a very little role in the actual analysis. It's interesting that one of Professor Owen's recommendations for addressing or helping to better define thresholds once you get into the consultation process is to use the recovery plan process. I actually think that is not only makes clear sense, but I think it's extremely helpful in helping the agency on a pre-conceptual basis define the standards. The unfortunate thing is that the services historically have taken that process. They have, by and large, used recovery plans as a process, largely as a discretionary process. They have almost completely divorced it from having any role, any significant role in regulatory aspects of what we do in Texas County, Texas itself. And the past clearest example of this are that we frequently see of biological opinion issues that lastly contradict specific recovery actions and how they're doing in recovery plans. That's the other example is with most listed species, they get on the list as a loss, whether it's a habitat. Many recovery plans, as either the first or second recovery action, they detect habitat, stop ongoing loss of habitat, and yet we see biological cleanup trials continuing to authorize, in some cases, fairly significant additional. And under that sort of scheme, for many species, particularly for species that are heavily dependent on federal land, it is difficult for me to see how we will ever get those species to the point of recovery. The other somewhat related issue, which again, I think all of these are issues that can be addressed within the current action to really implement the issues of administration. The other one is how the services services to threat to the threat. The service regulation, in my opinion, has had a very, very convoluted, confusing approach to dealing with communities. They're basically, the actual regulatory definition of communities is fairly narrow, which only applies to regional distributed non-federal actions. The thought process is really behind that is the reason to exclude regional distributed federal actions is the idea that those actions are going to require the run Section 7 classification, therefore you can deal with those impacts down the road. The analysis tends to focus on what's called the action area that can be defined as, in some cases, something much less than species entire range. And again, from my experience, that the agencies rarely do an effective job of assessing the effects of the given action, undergoing consultation, and writing all other ongoing tasks, as well as resources. And I think without that sort of analysis, and this is particularly a problem with relatively wide two examples. We have had, we've done work in the past with species called snowy pronghorn, found in the southwest. It relies fairly heavily on federal land, and it's a fairly diverse set of things. There's land management, CAD land, park service, and we brought litigation about 10 years ago. We challenged a number of service biologists to continue specifically to address the fact that what the Fish and Wildlife Service was not doing was really taking this big picture thing to look at what the impact of the pond was. And instead, what they were doing is they were approaching consultation on an agency by agency basis. And what we argued and what agreed that was really not providing sufficient big picture look at what the impact of pronghorn, which in turn was affecting an actual point of question. So the rejection so again, I think a more concerted effort to deal with these issues is in fact. I mean, the recovery planning process is another area that actually is going to help. Let me take a couple things specifically about critical habitat. I don't actually disagree with a lot of the data stuff. I think the funding shortfall for the service districts has always been a huge problem when it's only getting worse. I certainly don't see any prospects for substantial money funding, but we have got several hundred species that are likely to come on the next, I would also, as a general matter, agree that conceptually, given how critical habitat has really been defined, that habitat is for the conservation of some of the species, it probably makes more sense to actually have that process, that designation done during the recovery planning process, so long as we actually have a deadline in terms of time now for getting the recovery plan written. With all that being said, I think the critical habitat, both the designation process and then the subsequent protection to get the critical habitat, prohibition on destruction or adverse conservation, I would argue are the two provisions that I think have been most undermined by agency administration and implementation. The Fish and Wildlife Service in particular has flatly refused, notwithstanding a pretty clear statutory mandate, designate full time effective that change became initiated in the 90s when consultation was started bringing litigation for us the designation of full time advertising. The other, and in some ways I would argue perhaps more prevalent issue is the way the services have actually interpreted the substance protection as well as prohibition on destruction of administration. The services for years justified their investment for contract based on their beliefs, which in part was grounded in a regulatory definition that basically equated no adverse modification standards for the debt. And in effect, it became a self-fulfilling prophecy. The services defined the two in a way that it was impossible to distinguish the two. They then used that as a basis to say, we don't think third class debts provide any additional protection. We want them beyond the debt. And therefore, we don't think third class debts that regulatory definition was several years ago that struck down the service that's been operating without a new regulatory definition now for the past 6 years. There's been some talk of putting it in a new regulation place and haven't seen it yet. Unfortunately, what that I have seen is a continuation of this, again, belief that notwithstanding, I don't think there's legislative history, that Congress at least did believe that that was a central element to the service, I think, that continues to administer that to the human data, I think, really undermines the benefits that we should get from federal habitat. Professor Owen flashed up a couple lines from the Ninth Circuit, clearly this is a Ninth Circuit decision, which I find exceedingly troubling, and I fear is going to continue, again, to undermine what benefits we really should get from federal habitat. And that, I'll just read that again. This was a biological opinion involving critical habitats of several species with several hundred acres would be critical habitat would be destroyed. The service concluded that would not amount to adverse modification of critical habitat. Conservation would challenge that determination. And the court basically agreed with the Fish Service. And what they said was, after all, the projects would destroy only a very small percentage of each affected species of critical habitat. I think that statement sort of crystallizes how oftentimes services are administered, not just the no adverse modification program, but also the Jefferson Network, which I think is particularly pervasive in a lot of different species, which is it's just a small amount of habitat. It's going to take a few number of species. Really, what's the big deal? There's a lot left. We are seeing this play out in particular the desert tortoise, which is a species that we've been involved in. It's a relatively wide-ranging species. There's relatively still a lot of habitat out there. But it's also a species that was listed principally because of loss of regulation habitat. And yet we have seen biological opinion after biological opinion authorizing literally thousands of acres of additional loss of habitat. To a large extent, I think based on the idea that we still got a lot of habitat left out there, we still got a lot of tortoises. What is unclear, though, again, is the fact that Professor Owens, I think,
let me just very quickly just address a couple in terms of what I generally consider the benefits that we get with the asset that I don't think we get with simply possessing it. One is it really is the one provision of the statute that explicitly talks about and provides protection for habitat. Most people end up on the list because they're losing habitat. Personal habitat is really one provision that explicitly intends to address that issue. The other thing is the definition of personal habitat specifically allows for protection of non-occupied habitat. It is very difficult to get protection for unoccupied habitat in the absence of personal habitat. Very difficult to do that section 9. I have seen the service basically provide instructions to agencies that they need not even consult on actions that are going to impact non-occupied habitat. Why that's important is for, again, most species that end up on the list because of loss of habitat, they will never recover unless existing ranges and existing habitat can be expanded. And again, this is the one place in the statute to provide that protection. The other thing, and this gets to the average modification. Okay. Can I just finish this one? The Jeopardy standard has been, I think, fairly muddled, very difficult to define, at least on paper in theory. The standard that says no destruction or average modification for the habitat, I think, provides a much clearer standard. Those are just a couple of examples.
Whether they were protecting them or not, I think, is another question. And whether they were leaving tools on the table with tools and employees, I think, is another question. But I think that basic vision of a creative implementation of that is far more flexible. And if they're real people, they're still far more flexible than the conventional reason I suggest. I think it's quite true. The other interesting piece of this, so you asked what else we could do with the data. One thing I did not talk about in the paper, but it is interesting to me about the data set is each species we've been consulted on. Now, this is just fish, so I wasn't looking at all species. And so I don't know if this is representative of the broader point. But this is basically a one group. Most of the consultation documents that I looked at, and I can't give you an exact number, but I would say between the bull trout and then hunting cutthroat trout and then migratory salmon species. Some of the considerations before this is that the dangers probably have to do with salmon and trout, which I think you would widely agree are sort of economically valuable, charismatic species. So it suggests that sort of a statute to some extent being creatively used to move towards goals that are at least more widely supported perhaps in terms of protecting that high standard of costs. But that leads to one, if you could, a subtle disagreement that we may have, and I think that your field biologists also have, which is that they found that if there was more attention given to this adverse modification of prohibition, it could be a valuable tool in these toolbox. And there were some interesting quotes from the interview, from the paraphrase of the work that was active. But some of them were saying, this is something you could really work with. And then another, and this didn't make it into the article, which is a great quote, you know, paraphrase, and somebody said, you know, there's a disturbing number of people who could say that the public is not just anything, and a disturbing number of them are management. So the general thrust was, let's talk about this more. Let's take this concept of adverse modification and develop it further, and then we can do with this concept the same sort of theater work that we're doing with candidates in the selection agreement, to Jeopardy, with a number of other things. So I think that's probably what you got out of this question before you go off into questions.
It's not a news flash, really. Imagine, thank you, those are very insightful comments. One is, you're right, and I think you're right in believing that the ESA is at least a quite a flexible statute that provides opportunities to help species in a number of ways. And Bruce Babbitt and Dean and many others in the team in the 90s developed a whole toolbox of agreements, safe harbors, conservation agreements, insurances, et cetera, to facilitate that. I'd say that that is an area where we should be devoting more and more of our resources. And part of my concern about the very, very difficult task of acre by acre identifying critical habitats, that's a hugely resource-intensive exercise. And there never seem to be enough resources to put into negotiating with private parties on those issues. Two other quick points. One is a point in my comment that I think that your data backs up is that the listing decision itself is the most important decision. And we are seeing now that as further evidence of that, efforts to avoid listing are providing an enormous emphasis for conservation. And the dune sagebrush lizard, which was proposed for listing earlier this year, we were able to work with BLM in New Mexico, oil and gas industry in New Mexico, the folks in Texas state government and oil and gas in Texas, and protect upwards of 80% to 90% of the habitat of the dune sagebrush lizard through a variety of agreements with BLM and private oil and gas folks and ranchers, and avoid the listing. That's huge. That's the exercise that's underway now with greater sagebrush. And the key is to take advantage of it. The final point I want to make is increasingly, as we look at landscape level needs, going species by species is a problem. Can actually hold us back. And what we're seeing, and that's why we do more multi-species conservation planning activities right now, as we have done with the Lower Colorado, the Upper Colorado, now the Desert Renewable Energy Conservation Plan, the Headwaters Forest, multi-species. Now, in that context, what we are finding is that sometimes critical habitat that's been determined years ago, for example, for a state-listed species like the Mojave squirrel in the desert, that can actually be an impediment if we just sort of say, well, that's critical habitat. When you're looking at 22 million acres and trying to find out what's best for a variety of species, and you're pulled into one species and this is critical habitat for that species, that can actually inhibit good, broader conservation planning and activity. And I worry about that. And that's part of the problem of sort of drawing folks into what might be a rigid view of what is best for that species and broad number of species on the landscape. So, anyway, I don't know if that helps at all, but I do have to go. And it's been a pleasure. This is a
very nice interlude. And thank you, Professor Owen, for major contributions to this field.
Thank you for that. I mean, I work in the
just a quick response. Hopefully, quick response. I mean, I think in a sense, to me, this is the most interesting comment because comment is a map of the next research paper. And I think it highlights what I guess I'd call the critical habitat paradox. On the one hand, you have David Hayes saying it really makes no difference in terms of the outcome of our regulatory processes. And I think the data that I have is focused on the specific regulatory policies back that up. And then you have the counterstatement that actually it makes a big difference for regulated entities. And I think it stands to reason that if it is imposing costs on those regulated entities, it is creating incentives for them to avoid those costs, which may mean them having to avoid activities in some voluntary areas. For purposes of protecting species, that's great, and that's the economic signal that we would want the statute to send. And maybe there are better ways to send it or better approaches to use, but it suggests that critical habitat is having a big impact. And if you stop to think about it, it's quite weird. I mean, you think normally that in order for a statute to be effective, it means people's behavior has to be enforced. It doesn't work. If the agency charged with implementing it is saying, no, this doesn't change anything. It doesn't make a difference. So we have this, it seems like this sort of paradoxical situation where critical habitat protection isn't doing a whole lot to change agency behavior and is doing a lot to change private interests. Now, that said, that's what the liberty paper is about. In the short version, the BLI has reviewed the caveats are all there. In the longer version, I spent a couple of paragraphs talking about how, as you said, this is not a complete picture of the impact of critical habitat. And what this paper does not address is the reactions of private entities that are also of national interest, like Bureau of Reclamation, the Army Corps of Engineers, to critical habitat information. And the basic reason when I started out working on this paper, I thought I would try to take that on as well. And then I started getting into it and realized that 4,000 biological communities is enough, at least in proposals like this is really good enough. So that's a future project, but it's kind of exciting to have this comment because it gives a number of ideas. First, it's consistent with anecdotal stuff that I'm experiencing in this process about private entities going to great lengths to stay away from critical habitat or take more information to avoid designation. And so now the question is just how to devise a study with in a sort of rigorous way, kind of that dynamic, and then maybe looks at ways to make it work better. So it is less costly for regulated entities and yet still provides the same level.
I may have a brief response. I think that's a good point. However, the one thing I would say is I would now presume that significant cost implications for the real community is a benefit for the agency. That's kind of the point here is that the benefits are often cost than the cost. Part of our
I invite everyone, though, to take a break if you need to, and there's coffee in the back.
problems you identify. The fact that you don't have recovery planning for all species, that recovery plan is mandatory, there isn't any to generate them for all species, and then there's not going to be in place. I mean, I think those are significant issues. You alluded to those in the comments as well. But if you're going to sketch out a grand bargain here, it would probably look something like putting off critical habitat planning until recovery, but making recovery planning mandatory. So that would, I think that would respond to those two concerns. On the third one, there are two reasons why I think that is not an insurmountable problem. One is that what I'm suggesting is not that you have a sort of massive prescription for all the habitat actions you're going to take in the recovery plan and then have that guide every single session. It's much simpler than that. It's to have the services say, okay, here are some of the threats to the species. We've got an aggregate. We've done some of the large-scale planting in the case. We've got an aggregate sense of those threats. We also know something about where we're likely to see positive trends, where we might be seeing restoration projects. So, okay, how are we going to, if we allow, say, all projects into a certain threshold, or under a certain level of impact, to get through without qualifying that as an obligation. But we take these other actions, are we going to get through that? And if the answer is yes, then perhaps you've got a threshold that you can justify when you get it, that you can be predictable with, but it is consistent with the larger goal. If the answer is no, that's not going to work. We anticipate a lot of projects under that scale, and then perhaps you need to set a threshold or some other default set of mitigation measures that compensate for that. So I think we don't have to answer every section of every question in the recovery process, and we don't have to. We have to have complete intervention. This one question is one that the recovery process provides a useful reason. In the paper itself, there's an analogy here with the state of conservation. There, you have to figure out all the different sources that you're dealing with. And if you're going to exempt some from regulation, you have to go through a modeling process where you simulate the outcome. And if you don't have enough controls on other sources, and if your modeling has integrity to it, you just can't get through. The idea is that it's the same general concept, although perhaps not with the same level of detail within the implementation plan. And I think it could be confusing.
I'm going to respond to the observation of the effect certain habitats have on project management and and I think the argument that in some ways even having more of an impact for designated on private land. The extent that's occurring, the irony, I deal principally with the biological context of private land. The irony of that is that, at least in theory, where critical habitat and average conservation prohibition should have the most benefit is on Section 7. Section 7, again, it obviously affects private individuals, private landowners, but it only affects them being on the side of preservation fees. So, at least in theory, I would assume that where it would have the most benefit is on the side of my experience. That is often times where you see having, at least in terms of the way the agency. I gave the against the tortoise example. Species that have really the bulk of the habitat, certainly large concerns better land and fish development. And yet the fish biology